You're listening to Let's Talk, episode 66, brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network. Howdy, Father Corey Stika. Welcome to Let's Talk, our SQPN community podcast. Glad you can join us. We've got a couple of panelists with us here. One's returning and one's a new guest. First, Steve Nelson's back with us. How's it going, Steve?
Hey, it's going well. Let's go. It's going well. Fall is setting in here in central Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah.
For us, that means it finally got down to about 70.
Yeah, see, your fall's a little different than mine. You know, we had our first snowfall last week, so...
Right.
Yeah. And then the other panelist we have is a new panelist. Rob Corzine is joining us for the first time. Welcome, Rob.
Good to be here.
Why don't you introduce yourself? Let people know who you are.
Will do. My name is Rob Corzine. I was raised a fundamentalist Protestant, came into the church in the 90s, went to school at Steubenville, spent a few years doing public policy in Washington, D.C., and for the past 16 years, have been working with Dr. Scott Hahn at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, where I run academic programs.
Oh, wonderful. Well, what kind of programs is that you do there?
So we do publishing. So it's Emmaus Road Publishing and then Emmaus Academic. And then also there are about 60 scholars from around the country and a few around the world that are fellows of the St. Paul Center. And then we also publish the International Theological Journal Nova et Vetera.
Excellent.
And so a lot of the academic outreach, we spend a week every summer with about 20 doctoral students in theology. I think just past summer, we did the 12th annual Letter and Spirit Summer Institute. So there are about 130 of those graduates, and then we do a lot of outreach to priests, both providing tools to seminaries and two big priest conferences a year. So we keep busy, and then I do a weekly radio show on another network.
Oh, wonderful! Well, that's a good thing. And we don't mind if you promote other networks too. We like to promote all good media.
All right, Sundays at 2:30 Eastern Time, St. Paul Center presents on Relevant Radio.
Excellent, excellent. So I've had the opportunity to go to the priest conference, the first one in West Virginia a couple of years ago.
Nice.
And then I'm going to be going to the one in San Diego area this winter.
San Diego is a great time to leave the north and go to San Diego.
Yes, yes, in January, right after New Year. It'd be a good time to defrost. So I'm looking forward to it. The one a couple of years ago was fantastic, and I know this one will be as well. Well, we've invited you on not to talk about, you know, St. Paul Center, although obviously that's a good thing to talk about, but actually to talk about the feast that we are celebrating today as we're recording this. We're recording this on Monday, the 7th, October 7th. And that feast has a long history in the church. And it starts from a particular event. What's that event that led to this feast being established?
Yeah, it was it was in response to a battle that happened on this day in 1571. And if you talk to the Venetians, they'll tell you it's the Battle of Kurzularis. It was off the Kurzularis Island, but everyone else knows it as the Battle of Lepanto.
Battle of Lepanto. What happened in that battle?
There, a Christian fleet of the Holy League met a superior number of galleys. The galley at the time was the standard war vessel in the Mediterranean of the Ottoman Empire, and won a decisive victory. And the understanding at the time was that this was a highly unlikely victory. Right. I think it was a highly unlikely battle rather than a highly unlikely victory. As the battle was winding down, hundreds of miles away in Rome, the Pope walked to the window, opened the window, ended business for the day, says, let's celebrate the victory that has happened. Pope St. Pius V had asked the entire Christian world to be praying the rosary for the victory of the Holy League. And without waiting for human means to get the news, he announced that victory and subsequently established the Feast of Our Lady of Victory, which we now celebrate as the Feast of the Rosary.
Sure. Well, I mean, of course, we know he looked up on CNN's website. Oh, wait.
Yeah. On the Chiron there at the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Turkish Armada defeated.
You know, well, and of course, this was a major victory because the Ottoman Empire was the unstoppable force of the time. You know, nothing could stop them.
That's right. I mean, we think of we tend to look at the conflict between Islam and the West through 20th and 21st century eyes. But at the time, the West was very much on the defensive. Mm-hmm. And for a long time after that, the West would continue to be on the defensive. But after this, no longer at sea. It was a great turning point. It wasn't the turning point where the West began to move east, but it was the turning point where the Sultan had to decide land or sea. He couldn't do both.
Right.
And so the outcome of this battle freed the shores of the Western Mediterranean, the shores of Italy, from the constant threat up to that time of Muslim corsairs and raiders. And this was actually the second trip in a few years of a massive invasion fleet, because in 1565, a seemingly unstoppable armada had descended on the island of Malta. Mm. And the outcome of that battle had a significant effect on the outcome of this one.
Sure.
Rob, you mentioned galleys as the Turkish fleet.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I'm picturing, ships that are powered by rowers and things like that. Is that what you're describing?
That's absolutely right. On both sides, the Turkish fleet and the Christian fleet was largely composed of these low, long, sailing ships that could be rowed. And so they had large numbers of rowers. They could go very fast for very short periods of time. And the strategy of using galleys goes all the way back, to the Greco-Roman world. And it had been ramming for a long time. And then when you get really close, projectile weapons a little bit, but mostly ramming and then hand-to-hand battles. It was actually a technological advance in galley warfare that allowed the Romans to defeat the Carthaginians at sea. So this was an old technology that was about to be retired. And this battle was one of the ways in which you see a shift from just, rowing ships that ram and fight hand to hand to naval gunnery.
Hmm.
Okay. So did this precede naval gunnery then?
The ships all still had rams, but ramming was becoming less and less important. Every ship had one centerline gun. Like, you couldn't put guns in the sides of galleys. It would knock the sides in. But you could put one down the middle, and so the strategy was you aim the gun with the ship, you point them straight at the other side, you fire once, and then you just drive on through the smoke and get to the old fashioned fighting. And
I can see why they'd want to retire that as soon as they possibly could.
Yeah, what happened is that the Holy League, and especially the Venetians, had an experience a few years before at a battle on the North African coast where a larger, what they called a round ship, had held out for a long time because it had guns in the sides and was functionally a floating gun platform.
Hmm.
And so in this battle, they had a few of this, and they were so clumsy as ships that you had to use the galleys to tow them out front. But they had a number of these galleasses out front. And it turned out it was overwhelming firepower, and they weren't done when, like, normally it was one shot and then let's get to it hand to hand. But as the Turkish ships began passing them, they started taking fire from the sides. And so once the battle was joined, the Holy League was massively outnumbered, but the Turkish ships were massively outgunned. So I think the outcome of this battle was miraculous, but it wasn't a miraculous military victory that happened at the time. It was a miracle of grace that the battle ever happened, because there were a lot of forces trying to not allow this to come to be.
Sure. Sure. I think, yeah, it's kind of interesting you mention a lot of that, because when people think of military combat at sea, they think of master and commander.
Right.
And that was about 200 or so years after is where that set.
Yeah, and master and commander takes place during the Napoleonic Wars, where they were almost entirely sailing ships. Although becalmed sailing ships could be in trouble with small road gunboats that some harbor defenses used, but they were larger, heavier, faster, and massively gunned ships.
Now, a couple of times you mentioned the Holy League. What was the Holy League?
Yeah, so there's a book called Victory of the West by Niccolo Caponi. He's got this phenomenal chapter. I think it's called A League of Mistrust. And so this is Pope St. Pius V somehow getting all of these Christians who these Christian kingdoms and princedoms who disagreed with each other and were competing with each other. The Venetians were massive competitors of the Genoese and didn't do anything else together. And then you've got the Habsburg emperor in Spain. Some of them are vassals of his. Nobody wants the Florentines except the Pope. And somehow he gets them all together, not just to agree to work together and fight together, but some of them are providing ships. That's the Venetians for the large part. Some of them are providing money. The Pope himself is granting massive both tax breaks and just grants of money to make this happen. No one wants the Florentines. So the Pope buys their buys all of their ships and makes them papal ships, and somehow gets them for this, just this one moment, to sign a pact to band together and fight. It's a kind of crusading to fight to defend Christendom from the Ottoman Turks, and it was signed as a perpetual alliance. Like, this is what we're doing this year. Next year we'll do something else. A year after that we'll do something else. Mm. It lasted for exactly this one season, and the Spanish emperor didn't want to fight in the East. He didn't trust the Venetians to not bail out, which they had many times in the past. The Venetians would much rather have been trading with the Turks than fighting them. Mm. But at this moment, for sort of circumstantial reasons, they found themselves highly motivated to fight and join the league. The Spanish ships were not owned by, they were paid for by the Spanish emperor, but they were hired from the Genoese, and the commander of the Spanish ships was both under orders to, like, not let this come to a fight, and of course he was out money if they lost ships. So Andrea Doria was really had an agenda to keep this from ever coming to battle. They wanted the Holy League to operate recovering Spanish possessions in North Africa, not fighting, you know, off in the Eastern Mediterranean. There were so many reasons, humanly speaking, why this battle never should have happened. And then there were a number of reasons, again, humanly speaking, why the Christians should have lost. And on the other side, there was this saintly pope who was insistent and unstoppable, and behind him was Our Lady.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's interesting that to think about that. I mean, we think of there's some infighting like in the European Union today, and you know the countries don't agree, but by and large, it's not to this level. I mean, the idea that Europe was little more than city states at this point. I mean, everybody had their little fiefdom, everybody had their little kingdom, and they would help you if it helped them, but they weren't willing to put themselves out otherwise.
Yeah, and the French weren't there because they were allies of the Ottoman Turks as a way to counter the Habsburgs. They felt surrounded. They have Spain and Portugal on one side. They have the Austro-Hungarian parts of the empire. The Habsburgs at the time also had the Netherlands. The French felt surrounded, and so they were actually allies of the Turks, not because they were in favor of Islam, but because they were in favor of defending themselves from the Habsburgs. And so you do have this just massive disunity that that for this necessary moment is healed by this saintly pope who sort of come out of nowhere. And originally he got Pope Pius V, to give you a sense, was scandalous pope in Rome. The Roman society was scandalized when he became pope because he didn't name any of his nephews to be cardinals. He was cleaning up the corruption, and they said, "This is you're not taking care of your family. Your family values mean as pope, you should be engaging in all this nepotism." So he did eventually, I think, appoint one or two nephews, but they did a bad job, and he fired them. He was the man for that time, and really no one else could have brought together the Holy League and held it together. It actually there were guns drawn and almost open battle breaking out amongst the fleet on their way to the Battle of Lepanto when a fight broke out on one ship. One commander came and executed the people who started the fight, and then his countrymen came and almost started another battle before they ever found the Turkish fleet. It was indeed a league of mistrust.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure I've seen a sci-fi movie that has this kind of plot. Yeah. <You know? laughs> That's amazing.
Yeah, and Pius V was a pretty amazing pope when you look back at him, because shortly before this, we had the Council of Trent, which he called. He's the one who gave us what we now can call the extraordinary form, the traditional Latin Mass, the Mass of Pius V, whatever you want to call it. You know, the Mass that was celebrated up until 1969, 1970, he's the one who brought us that. He reformed the breviary. He reformed the clergy in Rome. I mean, he was quite the pope.
Christopher Dawson actually describes the Jesuits this way, but I think it applies maybe even better to Pope St. Pius V. He was a man with no commitments to the mistakes of the past. And he was there just to serve our Lord and Our Lady, and he was not politically sensitive about how he got that done.
So now, you mentioned something earlier that I had not heard, that he had a supernatural premonition of the victory.
Yeah, it was actually on. So to think about the geography here, there's the peninsula of Italy, right, like a boot, and then there's the Adriatic Sea to the right of the boot, and then you sail down around. And you're heading into the Western Mediterranean, and that's where the battle happened. So hundreds of miles away, on the day the battle happened, I don't think it's described at all as a vision or a locution, but we just have an account of Pius himself standing up from a meeting and saying, business is done for the day. He walks over and opens the window, says, let's just pray a prayer of thanksgiving. I think he had them pray a Te Deum for the victory that had happened.
That's incredible. You know, you joke about the technology, but I mean, at best, it would have been what, a week that before they would have actually heard the results of the battle by human means?
I think a week would have meant fair winds.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think they could have sailed to Brindisi and come up the Appian Way from it probably in a week with, you know, both good weather and fast horses. But it's not possible. There's no human possibility of getting the news that quickly by natural means.
That's incredible. What was his reaction? Not just the supernatural reaction, but what did he do to celebrate this victory? What was his what did he call for? Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. So in the run up to this, again, this is a phenomenally high risk enterprise. When we talk about the Habsburg emperor not wanting to risk battle, you know, a sea battle is a really dangerous thing because it can be an all or nothing. You lose your fleet, now you're completely exposed. And so it was an unlikely victory, and it was a huge and dangerous gamble. Mm-hmm. And but Pius V had called on the Christian world to prepare for this, not just by putting together a fleet and getting these enemies to agree, but by asking everyone to pray the rosary.
Right.
And when the victory came, he attributed the victory to Our Lady and to the power of her intercession through the rosary. There's actually, this is another interesting connection. One of the banners on the main ships was, we think of this as Europe and 16th century, so it was pretty quick, but they went into battle flying the banner of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Hmm. Yeah, that would have been, what, 30 years, maybe, somewhere in there?
Right around there. I mean, it was living generation.
I'm sure listeners will remember exact date. I just can't remember off the top of my head, but I know it's somewhere in the early to mid 1500s. So it's within living memory. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and when they closed battle and got to the hand to hand bits, the one of the other things that told was all of the missing the arquebusiers, the handheld guns, the flintlock, not flintlock, but matchlock weapons of the time. The Christians were massively outgunning the Turkish fleet as well, not because the Turks didn't use that technology, but because the elite fighting force of the Turkish Empire had been massively thin before the walls of the of San Angelo and Fort St. Elmo 6 years earlier in the siege of Malta, where a tiny handful of knights held off tens of thousands of the best siege warriors in perhaps in history, certainly in the early modern world.
Well, that's yeah.
So it was a compound kind of miracle. It was so many things had to happen for this to happen that no one would have given you odds that it could have, but Pope Pius V, you know, knew who to talk to, and he talked to Our Lady.
Nice.
So he instituted the feast of Our Lady of Victory at the end of this, and since the instrument of that victory had been the Rosary, we now celebrate it as the feast of Our Lady of the Rosary.
That's right. That's why we're recording this today on the feast of Our Lady of the Rosary. We're celebrating this on recording this on the anniversary of that battle. And one thing you kind of mentioned, we're talking about the fighting force. That's another thing. I don't know how many people realize that, but prior to this battle and after, there were a lot of sieges in Europe. There were a lot of cities that were put under siege for years sometimes.
Indeed, and it was so the two great ones in the Mediterranean had been the first siege of the Knights of St. John on Rhodes, on the island of Rhodes, and they had held out so long that that they fought the it was the first great battle of what the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, and they fought him to a standstill until he finally said, "Okay, this is getting way out of hand. If you leave, you can take your everyone can leave. You can take your ships. You can take your relics. Just go." And he thought they were done, and then they got from the Habsburg Emperor this tiny little rocky island of Malta and reestablished them there. So we now know of them as the Knights of Malta. And then in 1565, they were attacked there and held on just by their fingernails. There were a tiny handful of unwounded standing, and the fortifications had been turned to rubble before the Turks finally gave up and sailed away. At that point, they could have almost walked in. But they had their elite fighting force, the Janissaries, they were the shock troops of the Ottoman world, recruited from Christian territories. The law was that in order to fill the ranks of the Janissary Corps, they would tax Christian towns and families of the best and brightest and strongest and most healthy of their young male children, and raise them as celibate, radical Muslims who were faithful just to the Sultan, and they would charge anything. And they were the best trained and the best equipped troops in the world, and they died in the thousands before the walls first of Fort St. Elmo before it fell, and then before St. Angelo, so that they were missing in 1571. All of the troops that knew how to use arquebuses that could have provided gunfire for the Muslim fleet were not able to be replaced by then. And so Malta is one of in two ways. First, in the what they had done to the Janissaries in 1565, but second, it was the Romagos, with the knight, one of the Knights of Malta. They had a few ships left, one of the big galleys, but it was him who Don Juan of Austria, who was in nominal charge of the fleet, turned to on the day of the battle, and who convinced him not to listen to the other advisors, but that yes, the fleet is there and we have to fight them. And both fleets had bad intelligence and thought they had the other ones outnumbered. And so we're willing to fight, and it turns out the Christians were outnumbered, but the Muslims were outgunned.
That's incredible the way it works.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I could just listen to you talk about this all day.
No, it's interesting again to learn about this part of history, because I think this is an area of history, at least here in the United States, we really don't talk about.
Yeah.
You know, you hear a little bit of it, the Ottoman Empire and the spread of the Ottoman Empire, but to really get into the details of how the Ottoman Empire was such a threat to Europe for a long time.
And this was a great turning point in the Mediterranean, but the turning point on land didn't come for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
So they were continuing to attack across the Balkans, and they were not stopped definitively. Like, the high tide of Ottoman aggression is before the gates of Vienna,
right?
The last date, the high tide, the date after which they were turned back, was September 11th, mm-hmm. 1783. So they were on the march and on the advance for a long time, even after this.
Another 200 years after this battle.
Yep.
That's the time frame is just, it's astounding.
When when I went to Poland for World Youth Day when it was over there, and we went as part of, they call it the Days of the Diocese, where you live in the parish, in a parish for a couple of days and get to see Poland. You'll get to see the people. And we stayed at a parish in Bolesław, Poland, and it had this new church of 100 years old. That's a new church in Poland. And the altar reredos behind the altar there was just stunningly beautiful, all kinds of statues and painting and everything. And right in the middle was this image of Jan Sobieski and the Polish winged soldier, you know, the big wing over his head, presenting images of Islamic, the flag and the scimitar to Our Lady.
Mm.
And the pastor there, of course, unfortunately by translation, because he didn't speak English and we don't speak Polish, he said, "We Poles are not afraid of Islam. We beat him once, we'll beat him again." Because of course,
that's so true. The Poles, and of course, Jan Sobieski was the king of Poland, but the Grand Duke of Lithuania, and so a lot of those winged cavalry were also the Lithuanians.
Oh yeah. But there's something they still hold as a great pride today, that they were really the force that broke the back of the Ottoman Empire there at Vienna. And as you said, made it a turning point where then it pushed them further back to the point where they basically gave up.
Yeah. I mean, by then the numbers and the wealth weren't enough. They were technologically backward. Mm-hmm. And it was what we think of now. So, most people now think of the relationship between the East and the West, and think of the West in terms of aggressors or colonizers. But that's really to think in terms of a 19th and 20th century situation. For many hundreds of years, it was Christianity and Christendom and the Christian West defending itself against a militant expansionist Islam that had the benefit of being united.
Right. And that's the other thing, too. The Ottoman Empire was a united empire. It wasn't these little city-states fighting against each other. But it's also kind of interesting that at the same time all this is going on with the Ottoman conquests, you know, that had been going on for years, hundreds of years before the Battle of Lepanto and 100 years after, at this time the West is starting to look further west, as in the new land.
Yeah.
Here and trading around the Ottoman Empire and things like that.
Yeah, those are not unrelated. If you look at the journals of Christopher Columbus, for example, and a lot of the other explorers, the age of exploration is in many ways driven by the need to get to the East, to get some connection again, the Silk Road and the Spice Road, now that we're blocked by Islam.
That's right, because the Silk Road went right through the middle of the Ottoman Empire, basically.
That's right.
Yeah, and of course, if you study that history, Marco Polo and all that, you know how important that road was to trade between Europe and China and that area.
Yeah, and in Roman times, you have free trading going on, so that in the first century, there's enough trade going on that the Apostle Thomas gets to India, mm-hmm. and establishes Christianity on the Indian subcontinent, so that in the 18th century the Portuguese show up and find Christians already there.
Yeah, exactly.
But for hundreds of years that had been impossible to trade, and that's why they were trying to find a way, west and around Africa to reestablish the trade that they had lost, because there was no going through Islam. Mm-hmm.
Sure. No, absolutely. Yeah, it is interesting to look at all these different historical points. Just so much going on during that time. Again, we don't really study. And to be fair, I think most history is kind of an overview type history anyways, where it's, just get the rough, look at it. But to see so much detail that was going on, and especially with something like the Battle of Lepanto and how incredible it was that that victory happened.
Yeah. And modern historians like to think in terms of economics, mm-hmm. and that's not true. It's usually ideas, and usually the biggest ideas. So religion forms mm-hmm. civilization. Economics can tell you something about how you can, you know, feed and change your numbers and trade, but only the ultimate ideas, only ultimately religion, your the biggest ideas form civilizations.
Wow. That's incredible. Well, that seems like a good place to kind of wrap up, unless you have something else you want to share on or
about. No, I think that's good. If someone wants an easy read of that thing, that Roger Crowley's book Empires of the Sea is both solid history and reads like a modern novel. It's worthwhile getting to know it. It's not only where we come from, but phenomenal stories.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, that sounds good. Now, more things to check out. Always look forward to more books, as if I ever get to them all, but at least got to check them out, right? So very good. Well, we'll take a quick break here before we do our picks of the week. I always like to take this time to thank everyone for listening. We do appreciate everyone who listens to Let's Talk and all the SQPN community podcasts. We enjoy putting them on, and we hope you enjoy listening to them. If you do enjoy, please do like and share. We want people to find our shows, find these topics that we have that are of great interest. So please do share our shows. If you know, give them likes on Facebook, give them, also on YouTube. Give us feedback. You can share feedback there at Facebook or YouTube. When you listen to these shows, we definitely want to hear what you have to say, because that helps our shows as well. I also want to thank our Patreons. You know, of course, like any organization, it does take a little bit of money to keep them running. Fortunately, we're mostly volunteers, but we do have expenses that we need to keep being paid. So we greatly appreciate our Patreon supporters who help us out with that. If you would like to join our Patreon supporters, you can go to sqpn.com/give and there click the Patreon link, where you can sign up for a monthly contribution. And if you sign up at certain levels, we even have gifts that we send to you. So you can go check that out again at sqpn.com/give. So now we'll move on to our picks of the week. And Steve, why don't you go first for our pick?
Okay. So a couple of months ago, I was appointed to my parish's pastoral council. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we're doing as a team is we're working through the book Divine Renovation by mm-hmm. Father James Mallon. And so I recommend that. And, you know, the overall gist of the book is moving your parish from a maintenance sort of existence into a missionary existence. And that's something that we're really focused on with this. We have a brand new church. We're the biggest in our county. We're actually the only parish in our county. And so we have a real dynamic priest and with a mission of evangelizing our entire county. And part of that mission and part of that learning about it is this book. And so I highly recommend it. It's a tough read at the beginning, because it talks about a lot of the problems mm-hmm. in the church and the problems in parishes. So I can't wait to get to the end of the book.
Yeah, that's a very good one. That's one I've read as well, and it's excellent for kind of rethinking how the parishes should work, you know. And so it's something very much worth looking into. Rob, what would you like to promote as your pick this week?
Oh, it's a good question. Well, just launching this week is a new video study out mm-hmm. from the St. Paul Center about a book that came out a couple years ago, and it's fall mm-hmm. now, so it's not quite the holidays, but Emily Stimson Chapman's book, The Catholic Table, is this lovely book looking at, she suffered for some years from an eating disorder, and the her healing from that came from the insight that food wasn't the enemy or the way that she controls it. In fact, the most intimate communion that we have with God is that we eat. Mm. And that changed her life. That, and then discovering Pope St. John Paul's The Theology of the Body. So this is both moving and practical way to talk, to think about eating Eucharistically. And she talks about feasting and fasting and hospitality, and includes recipes. And so rather than just put the book out there, we've just done this video study where we filmed her in her home, both talking about her story and some of these other subjects. So it should be a lovely study to both watch and get together and cook and think about the theology of the body and faith and food and the sacramental worldview. You can get that at stpaulcenter.com.
St. Paul Center. Excellent. Yeah. We'll make sure to put links in the show notes. Sounds awesome. Sounds incredible. So my pick is, since we were talking about Pius V, actually related to the Pius V Mass, the extraordinary form, traditional Latin Mass. I'm one of a number of priests in my diocese that's been learning extraordinary form. And like, I celebrate every Saturday morning. I celebrate just a low extraordinary form Mass. Nice. But occasionally we get together for solemn high Masses, where if we can get three or four of us together, we can do the solemn high Mass. And one of the tough things about solemn high Masses is learning the proper chants, because you chant things like the introit, you chant the pre-communion antiphon, or the offertory antiphon, you chant the post-communion antiphon. You know, there's so many different little chants that you've got to learn. Well, there's a tool out there, and let's see, I can't remember who it was put out by, but it's basically a chant tool for both Android and iOS.
Cool.
And they have taken all the chants and put them in what's called GABC notation, which is a computer notation where it puts the letters. It's kind of like the old, if you've ever seen old style notation before we got to the five bar notation, where there was like ups and downs and, you know, accent marks and things like that. The old original chant notations. It's very similar to that, because it puts code in there for the computer so that it knows how to change that into a chant form, the four bar chant notation. But kind of one of the cool things from it here, and I don't know, hopefully this will come across the microphone, but you can actually play the chant. This is just my phone playing it. I don't know if...
Yeah.
Okay, now we stop. but the idea is, as you're learning the chant, if your cantor or your schola is trying to learn the chant, they can sit there and listen to that and play a little bit of it at a time, and pick up the chant, and, you know, instead of trying to do it by head, you know, somebody who's an experienced cantor can do it by head. You know, they've learned the tones enough and everything. But this tool makes it so much easier for that. You can also take music. You can take like the readings and put it to the different chant notations. And it's just a very powerful little tool. It might not be the
prettiest. That's pretty cool. What's it called again?
Chant tools. Yeah, so it's for both iOS and Android. You know, my brother priests all had iPhones, and they showed it to me, and I looked up, oh, it's on Android too. Well, I better grab that. and I think it would be a great tool as well if you're trying to learn chant as a whole, because chant is not hard. It is not hard to chant. It is very much a spoken thing just put to music. Yep. But still learning these proper chants can be very complex. You know, if you go through them, I mean, they've got lots of movement and lots of different steps and everything. So anyway, my pick's the chant tools for the extraordinary form on both Android and iOS. Well, thank you both again for coming on. Rob, where can people find you?
At the same website, at stpaulcenter.com.
Excellent. Yes. And lots of good stuff going on there. And I should mention too, you mentioned like some of the journals and stuff you work on. I've got a few of them sitting over in my bookshelf here too. So I'd hold them up, but it's too far away to grab. So
indeed. And of course, it's not just in the 16th century. It still is the case that liturgy moves history, mm-hmm. and the rosary can change the course of nations.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And Steve, where can people find you?
Probably the best place is on Twitter at Steve_Nelson.
Excellent. And Again, I'm Father Corey Stika. You can find my website, frcorey.org, where I post my homilies. You can find me on Facebook, Father Corey Stika. My Twitter handle is frcoreystika. If you'd like to send us feedback, as I said before, you can send it through our SQPN Facebook page or through or on YouTube at the SQPN page, or you can send us email at letstalk@sqpn.com. Thank you very much for listening, and God bless.